Committee on Commerce to order. We have Senate Bill 635 we're going to start off with, and Senator Mexter would like to join us. The reason we didn't start at 3 o'clock is because our schedule says we're not supposed to start till 3:10. And the other thing is that the five of us that sit on this committee are also are in judiciary, and we went until 3:01. So I told my committee, try to get there by 3:15, and we're close.
Well, I'm sure you did good work, Mr. Chair.
We did. At least that's what they told us upstairs.
Yeah, excellent.
Please get us started. Before you do, Senator, I will be in world of hurt if I do not let counsel to say her part before you get to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 635 requires workers' compensation coverage for adult foster care home givers, foster home caregivers. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement issued, and we have on our desk a letter from Mike Falanisi, who is opposed to Senate Bill 635.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and I'm going to be brief. The provisions will be discussed at length, I'm sure, by those testifying in support or in opposition to Senate Bill 635. I'm just going to make, first of all, a confession primarily, and that is going into this session, I made a commitment to myself. I was not going to sign on to any bill, had anything with the two words workers' comp. I also made a decision that if there were any bills that would be coming to the Senate, to ensure that they would not come to my committee but to your committee, Mr. Chair, that I was still in the healing process from the 2003 session. So I broke my rule.
One for two, huh?
Yeah, so I broke my rule here in that Senate Bill 635 does deal with the issue of workers' comp. And just briefly, and I think the long-term care ombudsman could even give you greater detail on this, this is a policy question to address today, and that is it proper public policy to ensure that those workers working in adult foster care homes have workers' comp? And why was the policy decision made in the first place? And I think you'll hear, as we have gone through the legislative history, this was instituted in 1991 with absolutely no public discussion of exempting people from adult foster care providers from workers' comp. There was a large discussion in the 1991 Legislative Assembly about exempting folks who would bring in foster children to their home. And I believe as they moved to the end of the 1991 session, I can only describe as skillful lobbying, as we are familiar with, someone injected the words foster providers in that bill without any public discussion, and it the discussion of having people who have foster kids in their house got added along with this provision. And there was never any public policy decision made about that. It was all about having foster kids in their house. So today we're going to have, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, as the committee, to have the public policy decision about those who work in foster adult foster care homes. Should they be protected by workers' comp insurance? And I believe the answer is absolutely yes. I will note just one provision of this bill. I'm familiar with the industry, having a mother-in-law who is now in an adult foster care home, and very, very grateful for the very wonderful people that provide this. The bill has been is limited to those who have actually moved into adult foster care providers as a commercial enterprise. So, for example, if you are providing adult foster care in your own home, which many of these are, you would still be exempted from that, because I understand the cost situation that's involved. But if you decide to make this a commercial enterprise and buy another home to do foster care and then hire other people to do that, where you are now a commercial operator, this would then the provision of this bill would require it. Though on those circumstances, you would have to provide workers' comp for those employees at these other facilities that you would have purchased. This, Mr. Chair, makes us consistent with all our other adult care providers. I think it's good public policy, and I appreciate you having the bill before you today.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Mexter? Thank you very much. I want to go ahead and call up a panel of four, the people that are listed at this point, at least on page one that I have, that are in favor of the bill. So Teresa Sims, Arthur Towers, May Dash, I believe, I hope, and Meredith Cote. If you four will come up, we can pull up one other chair, Mr. Towers, on the end there. I think that one is broke free. It's not. Maybe the one right next. They've got us all. We'll get one.
Okay. I can get one.
Okay.
You can give me the yellow.
I can do that. That's one thing I can do. Well, it looks like we only have three here.
You're right, we have one witness step out.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and y'all start, and we'll take off from there.
Okay.
And we can go in whatever order. Who's ever going to go first, please just state your name and then give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. The Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman investigates and resolves complaints made by or on behalf of the residents of long-term care facilities. We monitor long-term care facilities, and we advocate for changes that improve the residents' lives and their quality of life. And just by way of background, adult foster care homes are one of four types of long-term care facilities monitored by the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. These homes provide room and board and 24-hour care and services for compensation to five or fewer elderly or persons with disabilities who are 18 years or older and are not related to the provider. Under current law, an adult foster care home operator is not required to provide workers' compensation for employees providing care in the home, and as Senator Metzger indicated, this Senate Bill 635 would allow for homes that are more commercially oriented and do not have an owner-operator in residence. It would require them to provide workers' compensation. Adult foster care workers perform a full range of complex and challenging tasks, assisting with and monitoring medications, providing personal hygiene services, and assistance with activities of daily living, such as dressing, feeding, bathing, and mobility, are among their many duties. They also do housekeeping, cooking, and laundry. And caregivers frequently lift residents and help them from one place to another in the course of the work. Such activities carry a risk of injury to the workers. And as Senator Metzger indicated, there is no public policy reason at this point to support the exemption of workers from workers' comp protections. There's no legislative history that provides the basis for the 91 exemption. The Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman supports restoring workers' compensation coverage because such coverage will also carry the added benefit of encouraging adult foster care owners to engage in workplace training to prevent injuries. Residents are always well served by more and better training. We also believe that restoring workers' compensation coverage to the adult foster care home environment under these limited circumstances will support a more stable and skilled workforce, which is key to quality long-term care. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever's going to go next?
Okay.
What I need you to do, please, is take the microphone and point it in your direction so we can get on the
record. Okay.
Senator Prezanski and members of the committee, my name is Mae Dash, and I represent the Alzheimer's Network of Oregon. We are a Salem-based nonprofit organization, and our mission is to support the educational, social, and emotional needs of individuals with Alzheimer's disease and their families and caregivers, as well as to raise public awareness about the disease. An estimated 60 to 70% percent of the residents in Oregon's long-term care facilities, that's nursing homes, adult foster care homes, residential and assisted living facilities, suffer from some type of dementia, most commonly Alzheimer's disease. We strongly support Senate Bill 635, believing that every adult foster care home employee should be entitled to workers' compensation coverage. Such an employee typically cares for up to five fragile, often cognitively impaired residents. The possibility of injury to that caregiver is ever present, for he or she usually is the only able-bodied person available to lift or physically aid a resident, or to control a belligerent, confused Alzheimer's patient. By contrast, in the larger types of facilities, long-term care facilities, other staff can be called upon for help. Lack of workers' compensation is both discriminatory and unfair, for current law requires that employees in the three other types of long-term care facilities be covered. If injured, the minimum wage adult foster care employee or less than minimum wage resident manager rarely has health insurance for covering on-the-job injuries or funds for hiring a lawyer to seek compensation for those injuries. By continuing to exempt adult foster care employees from workers' compensation, the state inevitably plays a role in limiting the quality and quantity of available caregivers. Adult foster care employees compete in a marketplace of minimum wage jobs. Many of those jobs require limited skills and little responsibility, yet they provide workers' compensation coverage and often other benefits. Qualified underpaid caregivers, realizing that they will not be compensated for job-related injuries, may look elsewhere for employment. As a result, persons hired from the reduced pool of workers may lack the skills required for this often stressful job, a circumstance that increases the potential for patient abuse and substandard care. We strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 635. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Towers or Ms. Sims?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And we are here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 635. Our union represents 13,000 caregivers in the in-home setting under the Client Employee Provider Program. We also represent caregivers in skilled nursing facilities and nursing homes. I wanted to introduce Teresa Sims from here in Salem, who is one of our caregivers in the in-home care setting.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Sims. I'm a home care worker. In October 2004, our relative foster care home was reclassified as an adult foster home. And as a result, we lost our workman's comp. We had a decrease in pay. I was basically erased in the system. So this has been going on for about 7 or 8 months that I've not had any benefits. I also had health insurance, but that was taken away in October. On February 7th of 2005, we called a meeting at my place of work. There were two union representatives, two people from the state, my partner and I, and we were able to reach an agreement, and we got the original plan. I'm getting my health coverage again, but still I don't have workers' comp. And with the type of job that I have, it's important because there's a lot of lifting, and if I was to be injured, I could not work. And so I think this is very important.
Ms. Sims, are you complete with your testimony?
Have
you completed your testimony?
Yes.
Okay, now I'll open up the panel for questions.
Okay. I thought she could complete it.
Okay. I apologize.
Okay. I just wanted you to clarify what you were before and what you changed.
Before it was a relative foster home because both the ladies are related to each other. It's a family. And the state just came to our work, and they said that that program was no longer available. It just said that there was going to be budget cuts. And so we didn't have an option. That's the way it was going to be. And then we contacted the union, and they said, well, that's not supposed to happen yet. You know, it's not definite that they're going to do the budget cuts. So we negotiated, you know, and got the original plan back.
Except, so the relative foster home had the coverage because it was a relative foster home?
Well, that's what the state told us. They just said that plan was not available. And we feel that it was misrepresentation.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Towers, if you can help us just maybe get a framework as to where Ms. Sims works. It sounds like this was something that was actually a state employee position, and if you can give us a little bit more background as to
my understanding of the legislation is that we're talking about a different type of foster home than the situation that Ms. Sims was in. What we're concerned about, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, is making sure that there's fairness and equity across the board in terms of when someone goes to work, being able to do the work in such a way that they can not have the stress and the worry of if there's an injury from lifting, from bathing, from providing personal care, that they can get the sort of care that they need. We're able to help Ms. Sims clear up her situation, but in this other class of adult foster homes, we're very concerned that basic worker rights are not being protected.
Senator Wissett.
Chair Brzezinski, two or three short questions.
You bet.
What is the rate of insurance premium for $100 for these foster care employees?
of Senator Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, in terms of, I don't have the exact figure, in terms of the in-home care providers that that are currently covered under workers' compensation insurance. I know that there's been some controversy about the cost of that. We were concerned about that when caregivers like Ms. Sims first started receiving first started receiving workers' compensation insurance in the middle of last year, in April of 2004. However, when we negotiated the rates on that and the contract on that, we agreed that if those rates exceeded a certain level, based on the experience of in-home caregivers, we would reopen negotiations and find a way to pay that. The trigger on that was never reached. In other words, the rates never rose enough to trigger the reopener in the contract.
You justified that you don't know the exact premium, but could you estimate, is it $3, 3%, 5%, 21%, 30%?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, I don't have that information at my fingertips, but I can get that for you here this afternoon.
Appreciate that.
Not a problem.
Second question. This exemption has been in place for 14 years. Could you give us an example or an idea of how many complaints of non-compensable injuries that have been received?
Do any of you want to address that, or I'm happy to address that. Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, in regards to the incidents with injuries of this sort, the sort of worker that you're talking about in terms of doing this work is a low-wage worker making minimum wage, $7.50, $8 an hour. They're not the sort of person who's able to go out and always protect themselves in the case of injury. You're oftentimes talking about someone who will just scramble and make do with the best they can, knowing that they don't have health insurance, very difficult for them to get access to the legal system, those sorts of things. And so we're concerned that a lot of workers in this situation aren't going to speak up and protect themselves and protect their rights. It's an unorganized group of workers.
I appreciate that. Could you address the question, how many complaints have there been of non-compensable injuries?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, that's a number that I don't have at my fingertips.
Thank you. And the third question, how does this relate to a family that lives in their own home that provides foster care and the family members are the employees? Would those family members under this law be required to have workman's compensation?
Senator Whitsitt, the way I read the bill is that when an owner operator is in residence, there is not a requirement under this particular bill, Senate Bill 635. There would not be a requirement for workers' compensation coverage.
And that would be regardless of how many patients they were providing service to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the maximum that they residents that they could be providing services to is 5 for this license category.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the panel? I do have one that I'd like to follow up on. Senator Whitsitt said, Mr. Towers, if you can provide us whatever information you can get hold of as to those claims that could have been filed, so we just kind of know where we're at on that. And it's my understanding in reading and hearing Senator Metzger's testimony on page 3 of the bill, where it actually includes and makes the modification on line 19 and 20, it's my understanding that if you have the owner-operator, meaning the person who owns the house, and if they're actually in resident operating it, it doesn't matter if they have individuals working for them for compensation or no compensation, both of those would be excluded from needing to have workers' comp. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chair, that's how I understand the bill.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to start at the top of the list for those who are in opposition, at least on this page 1. Grover Sons, Dixie Ellert, and then I'm going to ask, I think it's D. Humphreys. Why don't the three of y'all come up, and then I'll have two more. The second panel will be Fred Albert and Jane Albert, and I think there's a second page, so we'll probably be adding more to it.
Good Good afternoon, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the adult foster homes in Oregon who are members of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. And if you'll forgive me, I'm just recovering from being absent a week with whatever's been going around here, so I'm a little weak voice at this moment. The association opposes Senate Bill 635, and we welcome this opportunity to tell the committee the reasons for our opposition. The bill mandates two things: that operators of two or more foster homes would have to buy workers' compensation insurance to cover their employees. And secondly, the owners of a single home would have to buy insurance if the provider does not live on the premises and does not do the hands-on caregiving. So there are two classifications of coverage. In both cases, the tax would be a new cost of doing business levied upon some of the smallest businesses in the state. While nobody knows the exact cost, we are told it could range from 4.1% to 9% per $100 of payroll. Just before the session today, I called seniors and people with disability, talked with their statistician, and said, what is the cost of the workers' compensation for the in-home caregivers who were recently unionized and are under workers' comp? And there was some testimony alluding to that earlier. And so I was told that the rate is 6.89% per $100 of payroll. Plus, they pay a 20% payroll administrative fee, an additional charge of 20% on the payroll as an administrative fee of some kind. But the premium rate, the core rate, is 6.89%. And that's information that we didn't have before. The primary reason for our opposition is simple to understand. Some providers cannot afford the price of purchasing this social insurance. Some would be put out of business. Nobody is against the concept of workers' compensation insurance per se. And I have always advised over many years that if a provider can afford the price to buy workers' comp, they should buy it because it's a good business practice. However, I know of only one foster home provider right now who currently has this coverage. By exempting single home providers who personally do the hands-on caregiving, most homes in Oregon would not have to buy the coverage. But such a law would further divide the industry and generate resentment based upon economic competition. The competition from assisted living facilities in recent years has almost killed the adult foster home business, as shown on the attached page of data from the 1993 through November 2004. That's the third page of the attached testimony. These statistics are from the Division of Seniors and People with Disability. The highest number of homes was in 1995, when there were 2,233 homes. Last November, there were 1,738. So a total of 435 homes have been closed in the last 10 years. That's 19.5%. The single most significant reason for all of these closures is that the Medicaid reimbursement rate is inadequate and it has taken its toll. I've represented the industry for approximately 20 years, and I've seen this trend, and we've been simply unable to turn it around, stop it, and it's now a critical condition for the industry as a whole. In our view, to impose a new business tax on this industry will cause some additional homes to shut their doors. This, in turn, will quicken the downward spiral in the industry and result in fewer and fewer private homes open to Oregonians who are elderly and disabled. to subscribe to the idea of fewer homes and deny the opportunity to be cared for in a private, non-institutionalized setting, it seems to me, is just not good public policy. Governor Kulongoski has consistently told Oregonians he wants no new taxes. So it puzzles me why this new tax on foster homes is being advocated, since it seems exactly opposite of the administration's goal. Finally, as thousands of residents in foster homes are on Medicaid, if Senate Bill 635 advances in the legislative process, we would respectfully ask that the bill be amended to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate to offset the increased cost of mandated insurance coverage dollar for dollar. An amendment of this type was written by legislative counsel the last time there was an effort to force foster homes to purchase workers' compensation insurance. I have some other notes, but I want to just thank the committee for considering our views on this issue and for giving us a chance to express our opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Who'd like to go next?
I'll be happy to. My name is Dee Humphreys.
Hi, Ms. Humphreys.
I've operated and owned two adult foster care homes for 10 years in July. I downsized to one for the last 2 years due to an illness of my child, but I also do guardianship and case management for Marion County. So I see both sides. I place seniors in it. And what I think the reason I'm opposing this bill is that what it's going to force, the way it's written, is poor. I'm not saying we don't need workman's comp. I'm saying we're targeting a group of people that goes against the standards of senior services. We encourage people to hire people so that you're not there 24/7 doing the work. So we're kind of going against what senior services is encouraging. We don't want a mother to sit there and take care of five people 24/7 where she can't get out to grocery shop, she can't get out to do any of this. So we want people to have a break. But if we're going to hire staff, then we're going to say you have to have workman's comp. They're not going to hire the staff. So that, to me, we need to kind of address the bill the way that it's written, or what it's going to force is people to go back to being multiple homeowners so that we can afford the workman's comp. The quality of care is going to be less. We're going to go to 7 and 10 homes so that we can afford it. I can't attend every doctor's appointment like I do now if I have that many homes. I mean, that's what I like to do. So I think we need to talk a little bit about the bill and how it's written. I had a personal experience with that. My mother was taking care of grandma, and I got the call. My mom died at 56, and my grandma was laying there. That's what we're going to see, is if we push this, people are going to go out of business or we're going to have multiple homes. The types of claims, the other thing that I didn't know if you're aware of, there are three different levels of care homes, 1, 2, and 3. If we wanted to ask that maybe level 3 care homes, which are the most dependent, your hospice, your lifting, if you want to ask them to have the workman's comp, it would certainly be acceptable, because 5 years ago I tried to get workman's comp. I called myself to say, I got the answer, your rate will be the same as Benedictine, Sunnyside. I'm not a nurse. I don't have any nurses. I don't do any shots. I don't have any bedridden. Why should my rate be the same as them? The other thing that's important to remember is that the rate for Medicaid that we're all talking about, for adult foster care, it's much less. And it probably should be. We don't have to have workman's comp. We don't have to have nurses. So our rate reimbursement is less than Benedictine or some, you know, other nursing facilities. But now if you're going to impose us that we have the same overhead as them, how do you expect us to make it work? I will be happy to open my checkbook up to any of you. There is no room for it. Unless, you know, people that are here opposing it, that's great, but come to SAFE and help us make them recognize us as an entity. The types of claims are going to be, I was in the kitchen, you know, cutting my thumb on a tomato. You're not going to see that in the other industry. They need to recognize us and get us a workable rate that we can afford and for the types of claims that they're really going to be, you know. As far as living in the home, if you're going to have an accident, you're going to have an accident. What difference does it make whether I'm sleeping in the next room or not? That, to me, makes no sense. If you're going to hire staff, which is what we want you to do so that you're not burnt out, let's see if I can answer any other questions for you. I pay health insurance for my clients, for my resident managers. I think it's important. I don't know if you have any questions for me, but...
You will. Okay. But we're going to go ahead and... But Ms. Let's see if I got that right. Ms. Elker?
Eller?
Eller,
yeah.
Ms. Eller?
Yeah. Okay, well, my points were that I've had two care homes for, 6 years, I guess. I had one for a long time. Now I have two. And I would probably have
just for the record, I need you to please put your name on the Give your full name.
Oh, my name's Dixie Ellard.
Thank you.
Yes, and I have two care homes in Silverton. And if I had to buy the workers' comp, I'd probably have to close one of the homes. And that would end up, I'd probably close both of them because it's not worth being in business. And someone earlier said that, you know, the mom-and-pop ones aren't commercial business. Well, they are. They're 24/7. You work really hard. And they are a business. I mean, they're just as much a business. One home is just as much a business as two homes are. And, you know, I have staff while I'm in the office doing my books. Well, it's like Dee says, you can get hurt just as easily when I'm there, when I'm not there. So I really oppose having this workers' comp. And we find that all the other care facilities besides us get a higher rate for Medicaid, and they can buy their workers' comp. Well, if ours was higher, we could probably buy it too, but for some reason ours is about a third to a half less is what the assisted living and nursing homes get for the same care. So anyway, that's probably about what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I've got a couple of questions, and Mr. Simmons, you talk about good public policy and such as to, I forget exactly what you're referring to at the time, but I guess, is it good public policy or not? Is it good public policy to have workers' comp for workers? I mean, it seems like when you're trying to get your members to do that when they can afford it, but I mean taking the cost away, just the issue of public policy, should we or should we not have that for workers?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's good public policy to ask employers to purchase workers' compensation insurance, but at the same time you have to provide for people who are doing this line of work, you have to provide enough income so they can do it and stay in business. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite a direct and fair answer to say, oh, it's good public policy and quit there. It's only good public policy if the people who are employed now and doing this line of work can continue in business. Otherwise, going out of business is not a policy that I would recommend.
Mr. Simmons, I'm just asking some different abstract type of questions. I guess I get to the point. I see two public policies here, and if it just comes down to dollars and cents only, if that's the issue, then maybe we can look at how we might be able to help facilitate part of that. The other concern I have is that if you have someone that is working for one of the homes that is injured, if they're not going to be able to get coverage through their health insurance because it's deemed to be on-the-job injury, then how do they get coverage, or who takes care of that? How do we pay for that injury and also the ability for new staff to come in or whatever? I mean, it just seems to me that we've got two competing interest issues, and I'd like to just kind of flesh some of this out.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we have a financial condition throughout the industry which is all-consuming. And it has been for a long, long time. The adult foster home industry is so underpaid that they're practically impoverished in lots of cases. And we've pleaded with the legislature over the years to do something about this under the concept of equal pay for equal work, for example. If we believe that the Medicaid reimbursement rate ought to rest on the level of impairment of the resident, not how many rooms there are, how fancy a place it is, how big the front lawn is. It ought to be based on the level of impairment. That ought to be the way that providers are compensated in long-term care. And recall that 60% of those funds are federal funds. I've always contended that if we had enough money, we'd bring a lawsuit and allege that there should be equal pay when federal money is involved based on impairment. But we've never had enough money to even initiate a lawsuit and test the issue. While I'm looking at my note, if I may, Mr. Chairman, another figure that Senior Services gave me earlier today, I said, well, I asked them the cost of workers' comp in home caregivers, which are not foster homes, but in-home care, and they gave me the figure, and I gave it to you, 6.89%. I said, well, what is the financial value of the governor's proposal in this current budget for foster homes? They propose to increase the base rate from $925 a month to $1,000, and then there would be two tiny cost of living increases. The value of that over the biennium would be 7.7%, according to the division, within the last hour. And so what you really get is a push. If the governor's budget is were adopted, we get 7.7% increase, and we turn around and pay somewhere around 6.8% or more. Some people have told me it's up as high as 9 in additional cost of doing business. So we haven't made a nickel. All we've done is just move the boxes around, and I did want to get that into the record. If you're entertaining the idea of helping the adult foster home industry, we certainly would welcome that. And that's why the last point of my written testimony said that if this bill advances, we would like an amendment to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate to offset the cost of the insurance dollar for dollar. By the way, that's an old concept. We've had it on the table any number of times, but I didn't want to fail to recall it.
No, you got it. I've actually highlighted it. So before Senator Witt said, I want to follow up on a couple other questions I had. Ms. Humphreys, you testified, and I just want to make sure we're both reading the bill correctly. It's your opinion, it sounded like, that even though you're in home, because you have hired staff, that you would be subject to this, or that you have to provide the service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
I've never lived in my home. I did it as a service. Most people, you can do adult foster care in a three-bedroom, two-bath home. I thought that the seniors would like it. I custom-built a seven-bedroom, seven-bath, so that each of the staff has their own room. I put monitors in there. They have a half a bath. It's more home-like, but they have all the amenities. Mm-hmm. So I've never lived in mine because I also have children, and a lot of people have never had kids. They don't want them around. I mean, I find that in 10 years. So,
okay.
I'm sorry.
So your home is not with you living in it. You have a separate.
That's correct.
Facility.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Whitson.
I want to just clarify something and get it on the record. You said that the premium was about 7%, rough figures. So on a regular minimum wage, $8 an hour type of job, that would compute out to about $1,100 a year for workman's compensation per employee at 7%. So the question is then, how many employees do you have?
I currently have two. We have a resident manager and we have a relief. But the reason that I wanted to bring up the Medicaid as well as Grover is that for every one private pay, you'll have 10 people that have Medicaid because of the poor planning that people have done and the cost that it's costing people to live longer. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need to tie in the Medicaid. As much as I hate to make that have an impact, there's no other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us, it's like the whole insurance issue that we're dealing with. You know, and for the record, every staff member that I hire signs an agreement that they know how much they're making, they know the hours that they're working, and that I do not carry workman's comp. And if they don't feel comfortable doing a job, they're to call me. I don't care if it's 2 in the morning. It's my job as the owner to do it and to make it work. I offer training. Sunnyside Care Center will bring out physical therapists and show them how to do proper lifting. It's free. Mm-hmm. Why would you not do it? I mean, there's ways to educate the staff.
I got one other question, and it's from Ms. Humphreys again. You talked about the level of care of homes 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
3, it sounded like it was the most severe or the most impaired.
It is. We don't have very many of them, and the last I checked, there was less than 5. I want to say there's only 2 left, and most of them, you have to be a nurse to run it. You have to have more experience, and what we call their ADLs, activities of daily living, have to be over 3. So probably 90% of us are level 2.
How would you classify your home as a type of...
I run a level 2 home. I've always run a level 2. I can do exceptions to run level 3 because I've been around so long. And I do that if I can. If we can get out in a lot of time for a fire drill, I'll have people go hospice, mm-hmm. and keep them longer and put on staff.
Lastly, regarding these levels, does the Medicaid reimbursement, is that reflected in a level 1 patient, 2, or 3, or is it the same?
Isn't it terrible? It's based on the facility that they live in.
Okay.
So even though they claim that it's based on the type of care that the person needs, how much you get based on where you go. So foster care gets about $1,600 a month is an average, where if they go to a nursing home, skilled, or whatever, they're going to get $3,900 to $4,200.
Okay.
Which
All right. Ms. Albert, I've asked a couple of different questions. Senator Wissip has too. Would you like to respond to any other questions we've asked, or are you comfortable with the answers you've heard?
Yeah, I think so. Just the staff. I have five staff members, and so
for two homes.
For two homes, yeah. They they go back and forth. So one thing was that if I have one home, does that count as just a single home that I live in? And then the other one is taxed or workers' comp, and that one I'm living in doesn't have workers' comp? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I mean,
because I am living in one of my homes.
I mean, my reading of it, and based on the people that are in support of it, it seems like one of those homes would not fall under the workers' comp, the other one would.
Yeah,
and based on the way I see it.
To me, that's discriminatory against the homes. So
it obviously brings up another question.
Go for it.
Does your do your employees work in only one home, or do they work interchangeably?
All four of them work in both homes.
Yeah.
And one's a resident manager, so she lives in the other home.
I understand.
All right. Before we leave, I encourage any of you to come to at least my foster care home. I know Dixie would love to have you. Come take a tour.
Come on out and look.
I have an extra bed. Come stay all night and see what it's like. I really encourage it. You should.
And then I don't know if Medicaid will pay for us.
You know what? I bet you bottom dollar they won't, but I'll give you a freebie.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. Fred Albert, Jane Albert, and is it Danielle Wild?
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Erin Danielle Wild.
Erin, okay.
I live in Tigard, Oregon, and I've owned my home since 1993. I have a level 3 home, and I've been the owner-operator up until 2 years ago, where I accidentally happened past a VA repo, and I bought a little house. So that entire time, I was on call, and they're at that home 7 days a week. The bottom line is that I don't take, well, they were mentioning level of care and maybe they should have workman's comp. The way I run my home is that I don't ask my employees to do anything I won't. And I am still there every day. I try to take 2 days off, but it doesn't really happen. But I don't do lifting because I can't do it myself. So I have different, even though it's a level 3 home, the people in there are various levels. I do have some level 3 people, but I also have 2s and even a 1. But the cost of the bottom line is I'm 52 years old. I can't work like I used to work. It's really hard work. I am really proud of my record and how my standing in the community and the references that I can provide. But when you are dealing with another added cost, I guess I can just sum it up and tell you, if I'm not full completely, if I don't have all five people in, I don't get paid. So another thing that you should understand about this business, the way it's evolved, is that you get placement agencies. That's where you get your referrals and your people from there. Well, they take 50% of your first month's rent. So if someone passes away on the way the standard contracts are written, if someone passes away on a certain date, you owe a refund. So if I'm only going to get paid if I'm completely full, there's still, if someone dies at the wrong time, and I hate to be blunt about it, mm-hmm. And then I pay an agency fee, I might not get paid for 2 months. So I know it's only, in my case, it would probably be about $128 a month. I might not have it, and heaven forbid if I had 2 vacancies. So, and I've been in the business a long time, and I don't want to go out of it. I don't want to change right now. But the pressures of running this business and doing a high-quality care like I do, it's a lot of pressure.
Thank you. And either Mr. or Mrs. Albert, whoever wants to start.
Good afternoon. My name is Fred Albert, and this is my wife, Jane. We have multiple homes. We have 7 foster care homes. what has happened through us through the years, we started out really well. We started out with one, and by the way, we had employees in that home too, because we as providers can't work 24/7, so you're going to have an employee. And I guess what I'm thinking of is it would put us on a different level if we had to provide workman's comp, because what the state pays for Medicaid, it doesn't cover everything. Liability insurance has been an issue with us. We pay about $2,500 a year for that alone per house. And what happens with workman's comp is, Grover said it's about 6.1 or 2%, if I recall. What happens if you have a lot of claims, in which we will have as soon as our employees find out they would be getting workman's comp, we would have claims. The amount you pay per year goes up. I know this because we have residential care facilities, and we do pay workman's comp. We pay anywhere from $3 to $6 per hundred. And it's just getting really expensive to run these foster care homes. And we've thought about closing some of them ourselves, because if they aren't full, you don't make anything. We pay, you know, we pay 14 employees, and that would amount to quite a bit of money per year. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Albert, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, my name is Jane Albert, and I just wanted to say that sometimes we take a lot of Medicaid clients, and a lot of our clients are either a base rate or a one add-on, which is the lowest amount you can get. And it's just hard because the liability insurance has gone up so much, and we have to carry that. It's, you know, foolish not to. But I realize, you know, what's going on. But a week or so ago, there was an article in the Statesman, and they were talking about in-home care, and they were saying that the state was having a hard time supporting that workman's comp for them. And so if they're having a hard time supporting that, how can they expect us to, you know, foster care homes to, you know, provide that? And so I don't have anything else to say about it unless you do.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay.
The last two people I have scheduled to speak on Bill 635 is Jim Carlson and John Stokes. Schultz, excuse me. I know better.
Ready?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Carlson, representing Oregon Healthcare Association. I wanted to start off by saying that I think a lot of what you heard from some of the providers here today, it's really important to understand the Medicaid system has been dramatically underfunded historically in terms of what folks are paid to take care of these folks. They don't get a lot of resources. It is very challenging work, and it's also very difficult and very important work. And so I think that's an important consideration. However, I think it is important to note that in terms of in the long-term care sector, amongst all the different types of providers, in-home care providers, both those that the state employs under the client employed provider program or in-home care agencies, residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, nursing facilities, all are subject to workers' compensation laws and wage and hour laws and a whole host of other regulations that historically foster care homes have been exempt from. So some of the discussion that you've heard about, you know, we should tie reimbursement, you know, to just level of impairment. What you've got under both state and federal regulations when you get into skilled nursing and you get into a lot of these other settings, you get into federal requirements, you've got some of the settings are required to have registered nurses on site 24/7 a day, a lot of other costs that are added to it, as well as you get folks who are at various stages of impairment. So all clients aren't exactly the same in that sense. I think in terms of on the Medicaid costs, it's important to note that foster care homes and residential care facilities are are reimbursed the exact same rate. They're under the same payment system. Residential care facilities are required to provide workers' compensation for their employees. Foster care homes are exempt from that, even though they're under the same payment system. Under the governor's budget, they're proposing to increase that rate for the foster care providers, not for the RCFs. The RCFs will still be subject to wage and hour laws, workers' comp, a lot of these other regulations, but will not be seeing the enhanced reimbursement. The representatives from SAFE in the back of the room did indicate that what you were looking at on projected costs here was not 7% of payroll, but 2.5% to 3.5% of payroll with a minimum premium of $500 per year. And so I think that would be good testimony to potentially get into in a little bit deeper to actually try to hang some actual costs to it, because it is a fairly minimal cost based upon the information that was provided by SAFE. And they do insure a number of foster care homes who choose to provide workers' comp coverage to their employees. I think also from one of the witnesses that you heard that they're having a real hard time with liability insurance coverage, both on affordability and accessibility. And this is a huge problem that goes across the healthcare community, long-term care community. But one thing in some conversations with some insurer representatives that I found was interesting, the fact that they do not have workers' compensation coverage makes them almost uninsurable, because that's additional risk and exposure to the liability insurer, because anything that would come out of any employment-related issues and like could potentially come under that policy. And so I think that there is actually a likelihood that workers' compensation coverage would actually help save money more than offset those additional costs on the liability insurance costs, as well as improve the accessibility of accessing liability insurance costs. And I think that's another issue, policy issues, that the committee could explore, where it could actually be a benefit to the providers and could actually help save money potentially on the liability insurance side. And so I think that's something that's worth exploring. One potential solution that I'd like to offer to the committee for your consideration that could help address the concerns you've heard from the foster care providers, as well as the concerns you've heard from other advocates about the lack of coverage here for this workforce in these commercial enterprises, would be that you could play with the effective date of a workers' comp coverage requirement. You could push that into the first day of next biennium. You could direct the Department of Human Services to pull together an interim group that would look at what some of these potential costs are and to actually get into the details of them, and then direct the department to take it into consideration when they're looking at their budget proposals for next biennium. And that might be a way to address the concerns that you've heard from your foster care providers, as well as to address the concerns I think you've heard from some of the advocates and consumer groups who'd expressed some concerns.
I do need to stop you and ask you about the concerns we'd be hearing from the co-chairs of Ways and Means.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually think if you take the numbers that Senator Whitsitt talked about, where he calculated out in the one example, I think $2,200 a year, and that was assuming at 7% of payroll. If you take the numbers that the SAFE representative gave me in the back of the room at 2.5% to 3.5%, and you're looking at a cost of $1,000 a year, I think the Medicaid reimbursement increase already included in the governor's budget would more than cover these additional costs being proposed now, and not the lion's share of it. And so part of what, you know, my suggestion was, let's have somebody actually put pen to paper, let's crunch the actual numbers, let's see if there's offsets on liability insurance costs, which I think they're very well, could be a strong likelihood that there would be, and let's take a look at it, because that reimbursement increase contained in the governor's budget could more than already address that particular cost this biennium.
Right.
So with that, I'd just like to stop and be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And you've heard a lot of testimony on this bill, so for once I'll be brief. You've got my written testimony in front of you. I'll just add a few things to what you've heard. You've heard some things regarding the protection that the workers' compensation system could afford the workers, and I won't go back over that. I just want to mention that as a result of the existing exemption on these workers, adult foster care employers themselves do not have the exclusive remedy protection that a covered employer is afforded under Oregon's system. And Mr. Carlson, I think, was alluding to the impact on other insurances there. That is an issue that I didn't want to to leave to the side. I also want to point out that we were estimating that there are about 2,500 adult foster care homes that would probably be obligated to obtain workers' compensation coverage under this bill. The last comment I'll make, two more comments, excuse me. One is that the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee supports this bill. And the last comment that I'll make is that I think the issue around percentage of payroll in terms of pure premium rate varies because of the differences in the homes themselves. If you've got essentially a daycare type foster care setup, you're looking at much lower rates than something that moves closer to a nursing care type facility, which would probably be is going to definitely have a higher amount per $100 of payroll. And again, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Senator Wessett, is your question?
Yeah, just a quick question for Mr. Schultz. On work injury experience, I mean, can you give us just a rough idea of the potential changes in rates as a result of a claim or two?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the potential is definitely there in this industry. One of the things that I think is often not understood is the amount of injury that does come along with the industry that is covered in this area. Certified nurses' aides, for example, and other types of care providers do suffer a lot of injuries if they're in an uncontrolled situation. And some of those injuries include assaults, batteries. It can be a very difficult environment. What that translates into is the frequency or the number of injuries that are incurred will have an effect on rates, as well as the severity of the injuries themselves. So it can be a situation where you might have several small injuries, which could push the rate up, or you can have a large injury in terms of severity, which could also have an effect on the rates. Typically, what you're going to see under the Oregon system, that the pure premium rate itself is going to remain the same based on the type of the home, but the rate tier that the insurance company will place that risk into can vary. So the multiplier on the pure premium rate goes up as the injury experience increases.
Yeah, I understand that. I was wondering if you could quantify that just a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'd probably have to get back to you with some specific examples. I wasn't prepared to answer those questions coming in today.
Well, I was thinking, you know, that some of our witnesses, if I may, some of our witnesses had two or five employees or whatever, and if you're dealing on a percentage basis, of course, if you have two employees and one of them's injured, that's 50%. Mm-hmm. If you have two out of five, that's 40%, you know. So, I mean, you get some idea of the potential liability that these owners would have, and how, so we could kind of evaluate how much jeopardy they actually, their slim profit margin might be in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'll do the best I can here off the top of my head. Some of these employers would likely find it difficult to obtain insurance in the voluntary market anyways, and they would likely go into what's known as the assigned risk pool or the residual market. That's not necessarily always a bad thing, although the rates are highest there, because there are discounts that are available to small employers or employers that are new. In fact, it is possible that you can get a better rate inside the assigned risk pool than you can in the voluntary market. But the impact of being in the assigned risk pool generally is that you're going to pay higher rates. So right off the bat, just the ability to obtain insurance in the voluntary market is, I think, a question that's worth exploring. Secondly, as you do obtain insurance in the voluntary market and you begin to have claims, different insurance companies will react differently to that. They're going to apply the same rating to them, but their underwriters are going to make different judgments. And I think one of the issues, and what you're, I think, asking about, is what impact is that going to have on the premium? A second impact is whether or not they would remain insured in the voluntary market at all, or if they would drop into the assigned risk pool. Now, to get to your question in terms of what's the impact on that, typically at the varying rate tiers, you're about your best multiplier is usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 106%, 107% of pure premium. That's the best rate that you're going to get. So what happens is that the insurer takes that pure premium rate and multiplies that by 106% to determine what the actual premium ought to be. The high-end tiers, you're looking at upwards of 150 to 160%. The assigned risk pool is going to be up in that neighborhood. So as an employer begins to experience more losses or greater losses, you can see an increase in premium of 40-50%. And I hope that was responsive to your question, Senator.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much. And if there's not anyone else here to testify on 635, I'm going to close the public hearing on 635. And we're going to be opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 469. As soon as we get the list up here, we'll let those people come forward. I'm going to call Tom Burrows up. And Tom, if you have anyone that you'd like to bring up with you, feel free to do so. If not, we'll work the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not have anybody with me today. They've all got patients lined up. So,
okay.
I'm Tom Burrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. I'm here on behalf of that association advocating for Senate Bill 469. What this bill does is seeks to return doctors of podiatric medicine to attending physician status within the workers' comp system. When the system was reformed 15 years ago, they did not have anybody representing them. They had one of their doctors over kind of checking on things. He was told that they were going to be included in the bill, went back to work, and ultimately they were not mentioned in the final version. They don't have a limited number of visits or anything like that. They just kind of don't exist. Since I was brought on a few years ago, I've tried to find if there was any pattern of abuses by DPMs, and we haven't been able to find anybody that can point to any problems that existed. When they were attending physicians, the doctors of podiatric medicine were very cost effective. I've included a chart there on the back of your testimony that shows that there were relatively small number of claims, and they were quite cost effective, among the lowest reimbursements of any providers. The second sheet I've got that I just found today is a note from 1997. You can see a different letterhead for the association then, that talks about the problems that the system, frankly, has encountered. Injured workers with foot and ankle injuries have had to kind of go through extra hoops to see both an attending physician and a treating physician for problems that one physician could take care of, which obviously increases their hassle, adds cost to the system, and delays proper treatment. And I'll just let you read that, but be happy to answer any questions.
One question, if I could. I'm assuming that if they came in, they'd be limited to their scope of their practice.
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
All right. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see. I have a dilemma here. I have a name that I probably am going to butcher, and that's Linda. Is it Barrow or Barno? Couldn't tell what the fourth letter was. We'll let you come up, and then we're going to let the other two come up because they forgot to say if they're for or against or neutral, so we're going to let them come up here on their together and tell us all about it.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Linda Barno, and I'm representing the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. Our association represents self-insured employers who are generally rich in benefits, the kind of benefits that employees seek in medical. We're opposed to Senate Bill 469. We've been involved with the legislative process and workers' compensation for many years, and we feel that strongly that one of the stabilizing forces in the workers' compensation system is the fact that during the reforms in the early 1990s that the definition of doctor and physician was limited. We were also a part of and truly support the managed care organization program in which podiatrists can be a part of. To give you a little history, I think what opened up, we feel, the Pandora's box was the last legislative session's entry of nurse practitioners into the definition of the attending physicians. This addition was made not due to because we needed nurse practitioners for their specialties, but we had a lack of treating providers in various areas in Oregon, and it was felt that by the addition of the nurse practitioners that we would be providing the services available to workers, injured workers throughout the state. So it's our position that we'd like to maintain what we think has been a very beneficial process in the state of Oregon with the limiting of the attending physician to physicians and doctors of osteopathic physicians, excuse me, and that we can have podiatrists and other type services working through the MCO processes, of which an employer can have more than one MCO if they choose to. I know personally my company has two MCOs so that we can meet our wide variety of workers.
Could you please define for me MCO?
Managed Care Organization.
Okay. And do you, let me ask if there's any questions for Ms. Barno.
I guess just one question that I would have. If you have someone who has a severe foot injury, and they are they go to their physician. That physician, under the current insurance, could then refer them on to that specialist. Is that true?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Because as they would prefer, could refer to an orthopedist depending on what they felt.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. John Schultz is coming back up, and Lisa Trussell. Lisa, do you want to go ahead and get started?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell here on behalf of AOI. And I didn't check the box, and the reason is that AOI continues to support the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and they haven't taken a position on this bill yet. But I just wanted to raise a couple of points, and Ms. Barno touched on one of them, is that when we developed the current system that we have of who can be an attending physician, we also created these creatures called managed care organizations, which a person who didn't meet the statutory definition of attending physician could contract with a managed care organization and have attending physician status. And it was interesting to note that at our last Management Labor Advisory Committee meeting, I think it was last Thursday, the department, Workers' Comp Division, came in and indicated that in the last 3 years, there have been no complaints from injured workers who are treating under an MCO that they've not been able to access the type of care they wanted to receive. And I think more importantly, there in the last 3 years, there have been no complaints from providers saying that they were unable to treat within an MCO. So I think that it's important to remember that we do have these managed care organizations, and whatever happens with this bill, the providers have access to the managed care networks if they want to continue treating that individual. And I think that MLAC's meeting again like this week to address these bills.
Great.
Thank you.
John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am John Schultz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today. In the workers' compensation system, only an attending physician, someone defined as an attending physician, can authorize temporary disability benefits, which is wage loss replacement, or make impairment findings on which permanent disability is rated. This bill would expand that authority so that podiatrists and podiatric surgeons would be included in that category as attending physicians. currently attending physicians includes medical doctors, doctors of osteopathy, and oral and maxillofacial surgeons, and I hope I pronounced that right, in the workers' compensation system. Currently, podiatric physicians can provide compensable medical services for 30 days from the date of injury, and after 30 days, they can provide further medical treatment if someone who qualifies as an attending physician refers a worker to them for care or back to them. And then Lisa also mentioned the ability to provide services under a managed care contract. This is one of four bills that are up this session to expand the definition of attending physician in the workers' compensation system. I wanted to note that last session, HB 3669 was passed, allowing an expansion in the authority of nurse practitioners to treat and authorize temporary disability to injured workers. That bill included a provision to evaluate the effect of this change and to report that evaluation back to the legislature. The expansion of the authority for nurse practitioners sunsets in January of 2008 unless the legislature takes action, and the timing of the report is such that it would provide the legislature with that information in 2007 so the legislature could decide whether that was an appropriate action or not. So we're evaluating the impact of expanding the authority of a group of treatment providers other than medical doctors or doctors of osteopathy already. We believe it's reasonable that we wait and see the results of this action before we do another expansion. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions?
Just one.
Yep.
Chair. Mr. Schultz, are you describing essentially attending physicians as a gateway physician that will go in and examine the individual, and then if they find a need for a specialist, they will refer them to that specialist? And if so, then are you saying that the gateway physician is the one who will determine the extent and the length of the compensable damage as opposed to the specialist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that is common, but it can also work that the worker will, their attending physician could also be the specialist themselves under current definition. So, for example, if the worker needs orthopedic care on their knee, perhaps knee surgery or something like that, they can have an orthopedist as their attending physician under this definition, the current law.
So if they had a primary foot injury, you would under current law, the attending physician could not be a podiatrist because they're not included in this group.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. Their care would be limited to provide treatment for 30 days, and the worker would have to select an attending physician under someone who qualifies. That attending physician would make the decision as to whether or not to refer back to the podiatric physician to continue to provide care. There is a provision in the law that podiatric physician or any other alternative care provider that doesn't qualify as an attending physician, that their care would have to be provided under the auspices of a treatment plan that is presented to the attending physician.
Okay.
And the exception to that would be inside a managed care organization, where the managed care organization's contract could include their contract supersedes that, and they could include having a worker being seen by these alternative providers who would function as the primary care physician in that respect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
No. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 469 unless someone runs up here real quick. And we'll open up a work session on 669. And I'm going to ask Art Hill if you'll come up. And I believe Kevin Wilson and is Andy Campbell. think all three of you are signed up living 100 miles away.
Do you really mean to be in work session?
Oh, did I say work session?
You did.
Oh, well, we can't go work session without a public hearing, can we? So, well, we're not quite there yet. It's sunshine or something outside has got my attention, I guess. So this will be only a public hearing at this point with the possibility of work session later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I was going to point out that you did that, so I was watching. Thank you for considering our bill. My name is Art Kyle, representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. With me are Doctors Harris Campbell and Kevin Wilson, who will testify. In listening to the previous bill, it's apparent that you've learned a good deal about the system. I want to offer a couple of differences here. We don't believe that the system is equitable, as was reported before in 1990 that the present statute was written, which excluded naturopathic physicians from it. Naturopaths were not represented at that time by anyone, and they were not able to become attending physicians. This bill that we're proposing here will work to place naturopathic physicians in the statute. They are not presently considered written in the statute at all. At the rear of my testimony is a chart that I prepared in conjunction with the staff at Workers' Compensation that lists the treatment status for attending physician, nurse practitioners, chiropractors, and naturopaths. And I think it's worth noting that under this program, naturopaths need the attending physician approval, can only treat with the MCO approval, and that is the issue that I definitely want to address, the MCO issue. I happened to meet the governor last fall and mentioned to him that naturopaths were interested in regaining status in workers' compensation. He had me meet with a couple of people from the AMLAC committee who told me that because, and the testimony that I just heard substantiated that there were no problems because naturopathic physicians could treat under the MCO auspices. There's a couple of problems with that. 59% of the workers in Oregon belong to MCOs. 41% do not. So initially, the so-called fairness of the MCO program is 60 to 40% roughly in favor of the MCOs. The MCOs, of which there are seven, which I understand are now going down to six, they're required by statute to provide three slots for every region in the state that they function in. And they can lose their accreditation if they do not. I took a look at one example, which is First Health Group has 13 geographical regions. 13 times 3, my arithmetic shows 39. I took the list of all of them, went through each page and counted them. There are 16 naturopaths listed with First Health Group. So First Health is in violation of the laws that workers' compensation are quoting. In my testimony as well, I've indicated the, because I was going to check on them, so I called them up. First Health wouldn't return my calls. First Health Plus wouldn't return my call. Kaiser indicated the panel was full and they wouldn't consider new applications. Managed Care Northwest is now closed to new applications. OSHU said there was no one available to answer my questions. Providence, the same issue. Only Oregon Health Systems was willing to discuss the issues. MCOs are not willing to take in new naturopathic physicians, and there are new ones joining all the time. So if one is graduating from the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, the chance of getting on an MCO is slim to none. In present, and I will not belabor these, in the state, we now have 475 licensed naturopathic physicians who have been trained with 4 years of pre-medical training and 4 years of naturopathic medical school, 250 in Portland, 85 in the suburbs, 140 in the rest of the state. And it's worth noting that two counties under the First Health plan jumped to my attention. Lane County has no naturopaths in First Health MCO. Eugene, and neither does Marion County here. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I think we're talking an issue of fairness, and even though the people from proceeded in the previous testimony concerned that it's fair, I think it's obvious that it's not fair. Naturopaths only want to do one thing. They want to treat the patients they presently have if they happen to be injured on the job. There's no expansion of practice considered. They merely want the ability to do that, and the two speakers following me will discuss those issues. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to go next.
Hi, Senator Przanski and committee. My name is Aris Campbell. I'm a naturopathic physician. I reside in Gresham, Oregon, and I've been in practice for 18 years. One of the first things I'd like, there's a few points that I'd like to make. I handed you some written testimony that belabors the points, but I'll just go over them briefly. The law, the workers' comp law, shows a great deal of respect for the doctor-patient relationships. And naturopathic physicians are trained as family practice doctors. We're not specialists. We can't say we specialize. We are just family practice doctors. We're trained in physical medicine. We're trained to do things like PTs do. We can do all those physical modalities. We have chiropractors that come in and train us. We're also trained in pharmacy. We have a very large formulary of drug things that we can give people if we want, and we can give alternative therapies too, which most of us actually prefer. So we bring in a new choice to the injured worker. I think that naturopathic physicians are the most cost-effective. I think initially when they reported how much different providers charged and cost per patient, it didn't take into account the fact that we're family practice doctors, so we evaluate the injured worker. When they come in, we've already seen them. We have a relationship established. We don't charge a new patient visit. We do the evaluation. We do physical therapy. We do things like what chiropractors do. We may put them on some medication, some pain medicine, but we can't take them off work. And sometimes that's exactly what they need. So in order for that to happen, we have to send them to an MD or a DO. Now that's a consult charge. That's the highest code. That's higher than a new patient charge. And that sometimes triples the cost of treatment just by that one referral. But the law demands that we do it, so we've been doing it. One of the things that has been happening over the last 15 years that I think is worth mentioning, the caseworkers, when you call up and report a injured worker, and I did this just recently, tend to misinform doctors, especially newly graduated doctors, of which I'm not one. And they try to tell us that there is no way that we can function in workers' comp. So the patient and the doctor are not being provided with the information that they need. So when they say, well, nobody's complaining, it's because nobody knows that they can complain. It's 15 years now they've been being told there's no mention of naturopath in the entire statute, even though it refers to us indirectly, and I do understand the conditions that I can treat patients under. I had a safe patient that I've treated for maybe 14 years. I'm her family doctor. She had a wall fall on her, and it was pushed over by an autistic kid. She caught it with her arm. It wrenched her entire back, and she came in to see me because I'm her doctor. And so I didn't know what, you know, I knew that I was going to have to send her to a DO or an MD. So I called up Safe and I said, what paperwork do you want me to fill out? you know, 827, and I waste one of her doctor, you know, one of her change of physician, if she needed to change physicians, I can't be her attending physician, so I can't send her for, you know, referrals. In 2 days, there was a DO that I work with that I sent her to, but wasn't available then. And she was seen and sent back to me for treatment. I was at the time when I called in, I was assured by the caseworker that there was no way, under any circumstance, that I could treat that patient. And she even gave me the number of the state ombudsman, who I called. And the state ombudsman called the caseworker back and told her, yeah, he can see the patient. But I still didn't know what form I was supposed to fill out. I found it really bothering that the DO that I worked with on this case, this particular case, was threatened with sanctions from the MCO for cooperating with me. We just need to be able to take care of our own patients. We don't want to start whole new businesses surrounding. We're family practice doctors. We're not physical medicine doctors. We're not orthopedic surgeons. We refer out for that kind of stuff. We just want to take care of our patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Wilson.
Senator Prozanski and members of the committee, thanks for listening. You have my written testimony, and I'll spare you actually reading it verbatim, but I wanted to make a few points. This is really a modest bill, and it's simply a request for some fairness and clarity in the statute. We are primary care physicians, licensed, examined, and regulated by the state of Oregon, yet we've been relegated to the status of other non-doctoral practitioners, such as massage therapists and the like. That is really inappropriate and unfair. As Dr. Campbell said, we're family practice doctors and we need to have continuity of care with our own patients. Furthermore, the confusion in the statute by not listing us specifically leads to all kinds of problems. The patients themselves, my own colleagues don't know that we are able to treat workers' comp cases. The insurers certainly don't know. And it's routine to call a managed care company and have them say, and I've had this happen to me within the last 2 months, that no, your type of provider is not covered by this. And I had to remind them that, indeed, we are by statute, and you better examine that. And they said, oh, okay, well, we'll send you an application form. Furthermore, another company that I apply to, they have an online registration process. Under the providers listed, there is no ND or naturopathic doctor category for providers at all. There is in remarkably small print, hard to find on there, saying if you don't find your profession listed here, call this 800 number and you can have an application mailed to you at some later date. So they've made the process to even participate in the managed care organizations remarkably difficult and really convoluted in a way that discourages people and also just is untimely in terms of continuity of care for our patients. So I'm asking you to consider this bill for the fairness and the clarity and making things better for the injured worker in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Just one question. It sounds to me that, based on what I've heard, that y'all are primary care providers for your patients. Can you tell me of how many times in your practice, or percentage-wise, you've actually had to go through this referral process where you've had a existing patient that has been injured on the job and you had to refer them to someone else?
Those kind illnesses come and illnesses go in family practice. You know, you may see 10 warts in a week and then you won't see another wart for another 6 months. So, you know, that's a pretty hard thing to quantify, but I would say overall in the last 18 years, maybe 10%.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's fair enough.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'd like to call a group up, and that will be John Schultz will be coming back up, Linda Barno, and Lisa Trussell. I'm going to, since we just had a bill up here just previously, which was 469, your testimony is similar to 469. Maybe we can just put that on the record. I got one other bill I need to get some testimony on.
Linda Barnum with OSA, that would be the same.
Okay. And for the same reasons that you gave before on 469.
That's correct.
Okay.
Lisa Trussell, AOI, the same.
John Schultz, with the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and it is the same, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now that I let you off the hook that way, do not leave.
Oh.
I have one question for you. I mean, this, to me, what I just heard from the proponents of the bill is that you do have individuals that are actually on the primary care level as compared to maybe the bill we heard before where we talked about foot doctors. I'm just trying to get some feedback as to why they may not have been put into the original group of being considered preferred primary care providers for this type of
Mr. Chair, Lisa Trussell, AOI. Looking around the room, I think I was the only one at Mahonia Hall, and I certainly don't claim to represent all 14 people that were there. But at the time, Oregon had a very generous provisions of who could be attending physicians, and it was almost like a domino effect of, and so in order to get a handle on cost from an employer's perspective, we wanted a medical doctor overseeing it. And I certainly can't speak for labor, but I think if you ask Mr. Shiprack, they also had concerns that they wanted an MD having medical oversight at some point if the worker hadn't recovered. So from my perspective, it was intentional that we looked at MDs and DOs and the myofascial surgeons. Frankly, that was because the Workers' Comp Division Administrator had a car wreck during the Mahonia Hall incident that required that sort of treatment.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, at least that's what my memory serves.
One other question. You stated, Ms. Trussell, that you understand AMLAC was going to be meeting on these various bills. Is this one of the bills that they're supposed to be taking up?
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
And I think it's later this week.
Probably on Thursday is the date they've been meeting.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm John Schultz, again, for the record. That's actually this next Monday.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you all.
Thank you.
And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 669, and that will leave us with one last bill for today, and I'll open up a public hearing on 573. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 573 revises the requirements for insurers' use of credit history to require an explanation by the insurance company when the credit history is used to make an adverse underwriting decision, and also provides restrictions on re-rating a policy when there is a change on family status or makes a policy change that requires an issuance of a new policy. There is a -1 amendment which takes that first part of it out, and also there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and that's all I have on that.
Okay. Joel, Ariel, if you'll come up first. It looks like we have three individuals that will be coming up after you that have not checked any of the boxes, and we'll let them speak for themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to speak in favor of the -1 amendments, which, as Anna's just told you, take out one of the two issues in this bill, but leave in the second issue. And let me just give you a brief context, and then I'll explain the -1s. The purpose of this bill really is to close some loopholes that we think are remaining from the 2003 legislation, where this legislature made a fundamental policy decision about credit scoring, which was to say that credit scoring should not be used with existing customers, but to allow it to continue to be used with new business. And I think that was probably a reasonable decision by the legislature at that time, listening to all the different sides of this issue. With existing customers, an insurer has a relationship. They know what kind of losses the customer is bringing to the company, and they know a lot about the the customer because of that business relationship. And so in that situation, to say that credit scoring isn't a necessary type of underwriting or rating tool, I think makes a lot of sense. You certainly heard from a lot of customers last session that were in a situation where they'd been with the company for a number of years and suddenly, without any kind of new loss history or anything, were penalized because of a credit score, and those kind of people had a difficult time understanding that situation, and that's why I think the legislature made the policy decision they did. When it comes to new business, it's a different situation. There's no relationship there, don't know the customer, there's a fair amount of information out there. I know we can get in disputes about whether it's actuarially predictable or not, but there's a fair amount of evidence out there that it is, and so the legislature said, fine, we'll allow this tool to be continued to be used with new customers. Of course, for us as regulators, that creates the problem of how do you draw the line between who's a new customer and who's an existing customer, and for us, it's usually easier to either say allow the tool to be used or prohibit the tool from being used, but when you say use it in this context but not in this one, the line drawing sometimes gets difficult, and that's what we're here on 573 with. We've seen some situations that we regard as problem situations under the principle that if you're an existing customer, you ought not to be credit scored. The specific situations that we started with on the bill were where someone goes through a death or divorce, a death of a spouse or a divorce. Those are often situations in which only one of the people has been scored in the past, because most insurers, or not, I shouldn't say most, but some insurers at least, only score one person initially, and so now there's a death or divorce, and they say, gee, this is the person that hasn't been scored, and they score them at that point, and that's oftentimes a particularly difficult sort of situation. Even states that allow use of credit scoring with existing customers have often said you can't, you have to give some allowance for a death and divorce situation, because that's a hardship situation. So we thought use of credit scoring in that kind of situation didn't make a lot of sense, and we basically had agreement from the industry not to do it in those kind of situations. So that was number one. Number two was we found out that some insurers, each time you add a car to your policy, buy a new car, trade in a car, really open up a new policy at that point. And although, to our knowledge, none of the insurers were actually using credit scoring again at that point, the way the law is written, they could, because they could call that a new policy, therefore not an existing policy, and so forth. So those were the two loopholes we were trying to close in the law. When we tried to write the specifics of how to deal with that, we run into a lot of problems. I thought we had it solved in the Dash 1 amendments. The reason why you have three people without any indication of what they're going to do is because they're telling me it's not quite solved yet. So at this point, I think this is a soluble issue for us. I think we can work with the parties to come up with a definition here. We would be prepared to support the Dash 1s, but we're also prepared, if you listen to the rest of the testimony, and say you guys should go back to work for a little bit of time and see if you can come up with a better way to draw the line here. We'd be prepared to do that. I will say that we would want a chance to come back to the committee and propose a bill. If we can't reach agreement, we think the current law will create a set of problems if it's allowed to exist as it is. We're happy to work a little longer on it, but we do think we need to do something in law here, or you will have situations where the intent of the 2003 law isn't met. The other issue that was taken out by the Dash 1s that we're not addressing anymore, to show our good faith on this issue, was we had some more specifics about how consumers needed to have better information about when a credit score was used against them in a new business situation. But when we heard a lot of objection to that from the industry, and we really inquired of our consumer complaint people, how many complaints do we get in this area, the answer was, well, people do understand enough now about why credit scoring works the way it does. So a lot of people still don't like it, but the problem really isn't lack of information. So in good faith, we dropped that part of the bill. So we're just down to this question of what happens in death, divorce, and kind of adding new property to the policy. And then you're going to hear a lot of, if they get into it today, a lot of parade of horribles about how the language we have really reaches a lot farther, and we'll try to work those things out.
That'll be fine. Thank you. Do you have any questions from Carol? We'll let them speak for themselves. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Powell, Mr. Miller, and Mr. Monroe. I always love looking at the paper and seeing names with nothing checked. Ryan Whitman.
I'm surprised if they say one thing.
Yeah, but three of them, only one thing will be said, right? Yeah. Okay. Whoever would like to start off?
In your dreams.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman and members, I think Mr. Arroyo expressed our horrors very well, and we will not go into any long detail at this particular time. I do believe that this problem came about due to the division's work with one insurance company who is not represented at this table.
I would assume they wouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, it's not that they're bad. It's just that there might be some disagreement. I also understand that there is more communications taking place between that particular insurer and the division. I need only remind the committee that the division does have a lot of power. This is a heavily regulated industry, and I hope that they will go ahead with that. Also, I do think that the language that deals with rescoring talks about consumers, not necessarily policies. So I'm not sure I agree that they have a problem. That's number one. Number two, the proposed language in the Dash 1 amendments has one of those, oh, by the way, anything else we ever want to say to you? And it says, or other change in personal status as defined by the director by rule, which is total rulemaking authority over any situation, and we do think that that's too broad. The other issue, we do not, at State Farm and at North Pacific, do not re-rate on marital status when there's a death or divorce. However, I believe states that have this kind of restrictions also have timelines, because people who separate, get divorced, and move on may move to another city, remarry, and at what point in time is this a new family, a new applicant? And again, we would be interested in some timeline, because State Farm has run into this dilemma with somebody coming back a couple years later on marital situations. So that is an issue that we'll just work with the department on. Because when you put the marital status issue on line 8 of their amendment with the provisions on line 10 and 12 on the purchase of new homes and that sort of thing, I think it is problematic.
And instead of commenting on that, I think the work groups can work on that. It seems to me that y'all should be able to work out something within a situation. To me, my first blush is that basically on immediacy upon that act occurring, we would expect that transferring the insurance would relate to being a new policy or a new rating or thing as compared to something 12 months, 18 months, 24 months down the road. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America with around 300 member companies doing business in the state of Oregon. And just to echo John's comments, I think the original intent of the bill dealing with the death or divorce, if you take on the amendment on line 8 and put a period after divorce and don't give the broad rulemaking authority, because those were the two issues that the division was trying to get at, you're not going to see any argument from my association. It's down in lines 10 and beyond, talking about the additions of motor vehicles or purchases of homes. And when my discussion, again, every company is different, obviously, that I represent. But the companies that I've talked to, for instance, on an auto policy, they're not going to re-rate somebody when you add a new a car. And these are some companies, add a car to the existing policy. I know Oregon Mutual, for example, you
you can actually put 9 automobiles on this existing policy, and they're not going to re-rate you. But homes, for example, are a little different. They're not going to re-rate you if you exchange your home as well. You know, sell your home, get a new home as an existing customer. I think you get into bigger problems with second homes. Again, these discussions, we have not had any of these discussions with the division, and that's why we want to talk about these scenarios. And as John indicated, I think there's just a whole bunch of issues revolving around lines 10 through 12 of the bill that I think needs further work, further discussion, because we're a little unclear how that could, and it could be very problematic to many of my members. So again, the original intent in line 8 with a period, I think we're fine with that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe speaking on behalf of the American Rental Association. And, you know, as long as I guess we're going forward with a work group discussion, there's, you know, not really a need to say anything else. The original bill was aimed at a very discreet situation. Clearly, the printed bill wasn't. The trending is good to the point that we've, you know, arrived at with the dash ones, but for consistent with what the other two have indicated, we don't know what the implications are of specifically 10 through 12, but they appear to encompass a situation where in year one you've had an auto policy and 5 years later you want to buy a homeowner's policy, and you might well end up not being able to fully evaluate that second application, despite the fact that you niche. Yeah, I mean, you might take every auto policy that looks decent to you on the front end, but your strategy for participating in the homeowners market might be only to write certain kinds of properties, and you want to fully evaluate those. And it would appear that this language wouldn't allow you to do it. So we'll look forward to working with the division, and we'll hope that we can find a happy medium.
Any questions? Gentlemen, I guess what I would say based on what I heard, I'd like for y'all to try to work this through if you could during this week. My first take on this is, Chair, I think what Mr. Miller said on line 8 sounds like a fair resolution, dropping the other part. Regarding 9 through 12, I'd like for y'all to get together. I think there's an intent here that probably wasn't captured in the words as to a new car being added on, one taken off, or a home being substituted or something like that. It seems to me that could be clarified and maybe more articulated, where everyone's on the same page. But y'all work through that, and if you can get back to Ms. Braun, I'd like to see if possible by Friday, Monday at the latest. That way we can go ahead and get it scheduled for this next week. I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are you going to be in Salem next week? You're not traveling?
Traveling?
Yeah. Somebody invited me to a committee hearing in Sweet Home and then in Bend.
No, we'll invite you the following week.
Okay.
Eugene.
The 14th, I think, is our scheduled meeting, and we are going to maybe have a topic or two that you might be wanting to participate in.
Thank you.
That will close.
I have a colonoscopy scheduled.
Yeah, that's more understandable. We'll close the committee.
That was good.